Luckily for you, the answer to the great question of life, the universe and everything is to be found in this podcast, A Worker's Guide to Everything. Sometimes cans, often bad language, always solid politics. This is the Trademark Belfast podcast. Listen out for Trademark regulars and very special comrade guests and fellow travellers talking all things lefty, Ireland and the world. We remain, as always, anti-sectarian, anti-racist and anti-fascist. Enjoy. Buenig saltas.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Trademark Podcast. My name's Sean Byers and this episode is part of our Potted History series, which takes a look at some of the key historical events and processes that have shaped the Ireland in which we live. Today I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Brian Hanley, who's going to talk to us about the subject of his most recent book on the impact of the Troubles in the Republic of Ireland. Brian, I know you're very busy, so I really appreciate you coming on to speak to us.
Oh, thanks. No problem. Delighted to be here.
Okay, well, just to jump straight in, I want to begin by asking you about the genesis of your book. I know it's not an entirely new departure for you, but what made you decide to devote a book to the subject?
Yeah, a lot of it was kind of personal experience in that I was born in 1969, so all my childhood and teenage years, the conflict in the north was always a backdrop. It says, you know, there's kind of buzzwords I can remember from being very small, like the Miami and you know, then things like H block and so on, which would be on the news. You wouldn't maybe quite understand what they meant. But so it always seemed to me that the north was always there. And then, you know, in later years, I found out that we lived near Drogheda in the early 70s, and my father and his workmates used to donate from their wages every week to the internees dependence fund. That was 1971, and my father and mother used to go and see groups like the Barleycorn, who the Men Behind the Wire was number one for 6 weeks in the pop charts in the south in late 71 into early 72. And there's other things I remember, like the first time I saw on Full Block Republican News, my mother had bought it. It was the issue just after the Warren Point and the assassination of Mountbatten and so on. So on the one hand, it seemed obvious to me that the North was an issue and a backdrop and was there, wasn't just, you know, completely irrelevant. But then I'd always read, you know, significant Irish historians like Joe Lee and Ronan Fanning and John A. Murphy at various stages talking about how little impact the Northern conflict had had on the South. They would usually say, outside of the emotional reaction to Bloody Sunday, this had almost no impact at all. And I didn't think that stood up. And the more I examined it, when I was doing other research on republicanism and so on, I said, well, there's kind of an untold story here about politics in the South. And I think people have come to realize that, because I know Dermot Ferger and Eamon Sweeney and other people in their books on the 70s and 80s have looked at the North, and people like Garóda Feilleán has done a book on the Provisional IRA in the South and so on. So I think there's more of an awareness now that it's an all-Ireland story, and the conflict isn't solely, it's waged most viciously, obviously, within the North itself, but it has an impact on the South too.
So just getting into the substance of the book itself, what were the main ways in which the outbreak of violence in the North affected Southern society? What sort of reaction did it produce in those early years in particular?
The first major reaction, I think, was an overwhelming feeling of solidarity with Northern nationalists. And that between 1969 and 1972, you see kind of wave after wave of popular protest in solidarity with nationalists. That actually starts in October 68, after the Derry Civil Rights March. You've quite big demonstrations in Dublin, addressed by people like Jerry Fitt and so on. The other thing is that Northern politicians have quite a high profile in the South in those years, and not just politicians, but activists like Bernadette Devlin and so on are very well known figures. And then you have August 69, demonstrations in Dublin and elsewhere demanding intervention or demanding, you know, the South do something about what's happening. You've got the arrival of refugees fleeing the violence. The thing I was interested in again was these protests tend to be cross-class, and the reaction is cross-class to some extent, featuring all sectors of society. But you do particularly have a response from the trade unions and from workers, whereby, you know, you've got unofficial strikes, you've got walkouts, you've got most explicitly after Bloody Sunday, where you've got a wave of unofficial strike action in response to what happened. And that reflects something else, which is, again, often forgotten, that in the 1960s, the Republic had the highest strike figures in Western Europe, and that the trade unions were considered to be extremely militant, but also that their members, you know, unofficial strikes were a major issue. The unions were tearing their hair out about what to do about them, because as Dennis Larkin, the leader of the Workers' Union of Ireland, once complained ironically that if one man stands outside a factory with a sign, nobody will go in. And he said, they don't even have that problem in Britain or France or elsewhere. And he saw it as a problem. But I think it also reflected that when the North was an issue, if people wanted to protest, they often protested by going on strike, you know, or by walking out of work. And then, and so I was very interested in that. And that was one way I wanted to look at it. The other way was that people contributed to support refugees or contributed to support internees financially. So there's hundreds of thousands of pounds raised between the Red Cross, the GAA, the Republican Movement, various local committees that are established to try and help. Northern Relief Committees and so on are a feature of life in the early 70s. So I thought that was pointed to a considerable popular impact. And it's universally in solidarity with nationalists. I mean, you see very few people who are arguing there's two sides to this story, or that, you know, there are people who are a bit worried about what's going to happen, but you don't have many people arguing the either unionist or British position in the kind of public sphere.
Yeah, as you've sort of alluded to there, and you say in the book, trade unionists and the left were amongst the most active in responding with campaigns and street protests. And that's unsurprising in many respects. And what I found really interesting is that they even developed an analysis that likened conditions in the North to those in the South. Housing, you know, workers' rights, civil liberties, and so on. That's a podcast in itself, I would say. But what about the Irish state itself? How did Jack Lynch's Fianna Fáil government respond?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because Fianna Fáil were actually being outflanked to some extent in the early stages in terms of their kind of commitment to aid Northern nationalists. And that goes back to the fact that they'd been in government since 1957. Obviously, people would be aware they're by far the largest party then, the most successful party. And in 1957, they'd introduced internment during the IRA's border campaign. And they'd also then in 1962 introduced special criminal courts. And that had been done by a government that included Charles Haughey and Neil Blaney and so on. And in the 60s, Fianna Fáil were associated more with the new policy of kind of detente with Northern Ireland. Firstly, they started to call it Northern Ireland, which no Southern politician had used those terms until the 1960s of any party. I mean, people might find it surprising, but Neil Blaney visited Stormont in 1964 and met Bill Craig, and they were discussing North-South cooperation, and there's no evidence that he complained about discrimination or anything like that. So, I mean, I think that the Fianna Fáil government by the late 60s were associated with quite a hard line in terms of their attitude towards housing protesters and student protesters and so on. And also then not really with a very assertive stance on the national question, such as it was. That changes after October 68. I think, you know, you've got speeches from Fine Gael politicians that seem more nationalistic. I mean, they say, what has Fianna Fáil done for our people in the North? You know, Labour certainly are taking the question very seriously. You've got a new confidence among Republicans. And there is that link between civil rights, North and South. The civil rights protesters in the North want PR introduced, proportional representation, to make the place more democratic. But Fianna Fáil are trying to abolish that in the South in 1968. So it's pointed out that the protesters in Derry want PR, but you want to get rid of it. So it's actually quite a difficult situation for them. And that then produces in 1969 a crisis of how to respond. And again, it's a completely different podcast, but there is a section of the party who want a more aggressive response. I think, you know, I would argue opportunistically think there's a chance for people like Neil Blaney or Charles Haughey to become Taoiseach out of this. Lynch and others, including a lot of the old guard, the old veterans, you know, people like Frank Aiken and so on, are much more cautious. And I think they very quickly realise that this has the potential to destabilise the South as well. The Irish Press, which is a really reliable guide to Fianna Fáil thinking, you know, that says, you know, that we've got to help our people in the north. Something must be done now about this orange dictatorship, essentially. But we've got to be careful of the wild men in the south who were on the streets of Dublin over the over the last week. And they're talking about attacks on the British embassy and rioting and so on, which a lot of ordinary kind of Dublin teenagers joined in at some point, you know, as well, which pointed again to other aspects of society that are changing. And so they're worried about stability. I mean, Fianna Fáil threatened, the Jack Lynch government threatened to introduce internment in December 1970. And again, it was pointed out, you know, that the unionists hadn't done that yet. And when they did introduce internment in August 71 and the Fianna Fáil government were outraged, Craig and others said, but you were talking about doing this last year. So there is these contradictions. But I think they're aware that the North could be destabilizing. And how do you put pressure on the British and the unionists without, I think they rule out actual intervention pretty quickly. But again, that's a whole, there's a cottage industry now about the arms trial and about all those things. But I was more, what I tend to find when people are really, you know, obsessed about, you know, could there have been an invasion and so on, is that they tend to ignore the popular mood all the time. They don't look at how politicians were influenced by the numbers on the streets or by the kind of reaction of people. And that had begun to cool by September, October 69, as people were kind of standing back and saying, well, what's going to happen now? And then it revives again after the Falls curfew to some extent, certainly after internment, and again, most dramatically after Bloody Sunday, when you have that real, you know, kind of upsurge in popular feeling again.
And one of the main historical parallels, I suppose, with the 1920 to 22 period is that you have thousands of people fleeing into the south to escape the violence in the north, particularly from Belfast. How were those northern refugees received compared with that earlier period?
Yeah, there is a lot of parallels. And obviously in 1922, they weren't there for too long. But initially in August 1969, there's huge amount of local activity to try and house refugees, to raise money for them. You've got kids from Ardoyne brought to Limerick, for example. You've got families from Andersonstown who go to Mullingar. And then you also have the state's response, which is essentially the Irish Army put in charge of placing people in camps. Gormanstown in County Meath, for example, where Ukrainians are actually being housed now, is one of the first camps. And there's mixed responses from the refugees themselves, because a lot of the time the conditions are very rudimentary and so on. And most people go back pretty quickly, although a few do stay. And you also then have people beginning to move to border towns and so on. Initially, there is, again, a great deal of sympathy for them. And then you've got successive waves in July 1970, August 1971, thousands come south after internment, and the state response is actually overwhelmed. They have to ask the Catholic Church and so on to open convents and monasteries, and also the schools, which are on holiday, then schools are used to house people. And you begin to see then some friction, a lot of complaints by the refugees about the level of care. Although again, there are some people who are very grateful to be given refuge, and some noting of you know, the fact that refugees seem to be quick to complain about their conditions. Why aren't they grateful for what's being done for them? There's always this sense that as long as the refugees are victims, people are sympathetic towards them. But as soon as there's an incident involving kids from the north, or there's complaints about conditions, there's this sense that they're not being very grateful for all we're doing for them. And then in July 1972, over 10,000 come south. It's the worst month of 1972. When the provisional IRA ceasefire breaks down and you've got a whole series of things happen. I think over 50 people are killed that month. So thousands of people flee. And again, there's a huge popular response and people are housed and there's all kinds of local efforts. But you also begin to see complaints publicly from people that these people now are coming for a holiday, basically, and that they're not fleeing violence, really, that they're coming here because they know they'll get put up for free and they'll get everything for free. And in retrospect, that sounds very strange, because quite clearly there's intense violence. A lot of these people are coming from, for example, Lenadoon and places like this in Ballymurphy, where there's a lot of violence that month. But you see that view publicly expressed, and then privately you also see the state being more and more worried about this influx and about their ability to one, provide for them on a long-term basis, but also then this idea that, because if you in Belfast, you could go to Great Victoria Street Station, say that you wanted to go to the south as a refugee, and you were given tickets, and you were then met at Connolly Station in Dublin and brought somewhere, that basically the civil servants' view is that these people are using that to come on their holidays, and that people came with suitcases and all their stuff packed and all the rest of it. And that view, I think, begins to, what they suggest is that if this happens again, it's going to be a major problem. It doesn't happen again at all at that level. That's really the last major influx. But there are a lot more tensions in border towns and complaints, and you begin to see in places like Dundalk this idea of the Northerners, or whatever they're called, basically intruding or invading. And that's where you begin to see this sense that, yeah, the North is a different place and they do things differently. And even if we're supposed to be sympathetic towards them, there's a maverick TD, Joe Lenehan, who'd been in Fianna Fáil and in Fine Gael. He's independent by 72. He says, well, that we gave these people refuge and then they wrecked every place they went. You know, they were the architects of their own destruction, he said. And that's a kind of, he expresses that in Dáil Éireann, but that would have been a view that you would have heard more and more by the summer of 1972. While at the same time, there's still a great deal of local efforts to kind of make people welcome.
Those sort of sentiments sound very familiar, you know, in terms of the current context. You might not be able to answer this, but did those sentiments like manifest themselves in any sort of confrontations or violence or anything of that nature?
There is confrontations. It's very hard to kind of, there's in Donegal, I'm trying to remember which town now, there's a series of riots late in 72 where you've got Republican protests usually that end up in confrontation with the Gardaí. And in one place, local men come out and back up the Gardaí in the clashes, and they blame people who've come across from Strabane for the trouble. You get again in Monaghan and so on, the Gardaí writing that essentially the protest had been peaceful until the people from Armagh arrived or so on. So there's a lot of, in Dundalk, there's a big riot, September 72, a local priest says, we've given people refuge, but now, you know, if they're going to come here and start wrecking our town, we'll have to take a different view. So that sense is there, and there is, you know, some clashes. In Dublin in 73, there's an interesting one where people coming back from the Provisional Republican Commemoration at Bowdenstown, they stop in Dublin city centre, I think probably for refreshments, and the buses are parked up in the city centre. And what is described as skinheads, which would have probably been boot boys by that stage actually, but lots of inner city Dublin kids who hang around the city centre. I don't know how it starts. You know, it's probably inevitable it starts with somebody saying something to somebody, but there's running battles in O'Connell Street between the Dublin youths and the Northerners, who obviously aren't going to take it lying down. And bus windows are smashed, and, you know, people are stabbed. And what the press describe as a three-way struggle between Gardaí, Northerners and Dublin skinheads. The provisionals complain that the Gardaí take the side of the skinheads, which would be pretty unusual, you know, but, and that, you know, they use terms like Northern bastards and so on, go back to where you're from. And there's, you know, there's fights at places like Butlin's holiday camp, and people from Belfast are banned for a period because they're blamed for trouble there. So there would be that sense of, yeah, people clashing, but among teenagers, that could happen really for any kind of reason, I suppose. But it does, again, it does kind of, in some senses, give you an idea of this widening gulf, which, you know, you can read a certain amount into, but again, possibly not too much either, you know?
Yeah, yeah. There, at different points, as you said, during the conflict, including the 1972, there are fears of a more full-blown sort of civil war spilling over into the South. And those fears, of course, we know they never materialized, but you do show that bombs, gun attacks, sectarian tensions and intimidation were a much bigger feature of Southern life than previously imagined, particularly in the mid-70s. I mean, I was really surprised to learn about how much occurred, not just in the border counties, but further down the country, in Dublin and elsewhere. So what impact did that have on broader public opinion in terms of their attitudes towards the North?
Yeah, I think there's a real sense of fear, and it's kind of exemplified by the head of the Catholic Church, Cardinal Conway, whereas in the United Kingdom, they had the Queen on Christmas Day. On RTE, they had Cardinal Conway on Christmas Day, 1971. And his Christmas message was about essentially the North spilling over into the South. And he likened it to a boiling volcano. And he says, people in Dublin, life is so peaceful at the moment, but you don't realise how quickly that could change. Now, he was kind of making a general point about society and violence, I think. But that fear of a civil war is expressed, again, by a range of political figures from Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Labour, trade unionists, and so on, in the winter of 1971, even before Bloody Sunday, this sense that things were getting out of control and they could spill over into the South very easily. And depending on your political perspective, obviously, that, you know, you would blame either the British for that or the, you know, the IRA or Republicans. And then the violence does escalate. And I suppose it goes along with, again, that the Fianna Fáil government that's in power at the time starts to introduce much more stringent security legislation. And their argument is that things are getting out of control. You'd had what was, I mean, things were changing already in the 60s in terms of crime and so on, but it was a pretty peaceful, stable society. Lots going on underneath the course, which was pretty terrible. But in terms of armed violence, there was really very little. And then suddenly after 1970, you've got an escalation in bank robberies and post office robberies, but also then in the kind of appearance of firearms, you know, during these robberies, or the open kind of, you know, there's, everybody knows there's training camps and so on taking place. And there's that kind of sense that, you know, even people in the South would have said, well, the IRA is able to kind of do an awful lot here and not get into trouble. And that is changing by 1971. But there is a kind of a sense that violence is coming. And I suppose there's different types of one, the loyalists begin to target the South. And they're doing that from 1969. You know, the first person, I suppose you could say, that's killed as a result of the conflict is a loyalist who's blown up in Ballyshannon, planting a bomb at the power station there. But there's a whole series of, in retrospect, what look like kind of minor bombings of things like the Wolfe Tone Monument or the O'Connell Monument at Glasnevin. Now, again, in retrospect, they seem minor because far worse things happen. But of course, at the time, it would seem pretty shocking that there's bombs going off. And then obviously you have, by 1972, much more deadly attacks, which again are a whole other area of discussion, really. Certainly by December 1972, you've got people killed by bombs in Dublin, people killed in Cavan and in Donegal as well. And that occurs right throughout the mid-70s, most notoriously in May 1974 with the Dublin-Monaghan bombs. But bomb scares are kind of routine, and there's bombs not just in Dublin, but in other towns as well. So another feature of life is that when somebody phones in a bomb scare, it's taken seriously. So there's regular kind of evacuations and kind of panic. Because the Gardaí are largely unarmed, the Irish Army effectively become part of day-to-day life as well. So they guard banks and escort money, but they also are called out for a whole range of other things, including in the early 70s, policing protests. So people might, again, be surprised that rubber bullets and tear gas are used by the Irish Army during protests in 1972 and 1973 in different parts of the Republic. And then you also have violence linked to Republicans, which is either during Republican feuds or during robberies in which people are killed as well occasionally, or against state forces, which, again, I understand why people in the North are often really annoyed by this, you know, the fact that people in the South would talk about the killing of a Garda, for example, and unionists would say, well, hundreds of RUC men were killed, or Republicans would say, well, hundreds of people were killed in the North. But the South saw itself as being at peace, and the Gardaí were widely accepted as a police force. So even the shooting of one Garda has a big, big ripple effect in terms of this sense of things are coming apart. So you can examine the extent to which they were coming apart. Some people would argue it was remarkably stable, but I can sense that. You've got to remember as well that people were really optimistic in some ways about where the Republic was going since the 60s. You know, that it seemed to be, you know, becoming a far more open society, a more prosperous society in comparison to the years before. And then that's knocked back by the international recession. And that had nothing to do with the North, but people sensed that the North is dragging us down as well. And plus, millions are being spent on security. Tourism declines quite a bit for quite a while because of the violence as well. and the sense that people outside it just say, well, that's Ireland, so I'm not going to go there. So there's that kind of sense the North is dragging us down. At an individual day-to-day level, people who lived in border areas have a very different experience, I would say, than people who live much further south. But there is that kind of, that fear, certainly up till the mid-70s, of this spillover. And again, they certainly 74, 75, in official circles, there's a real fear that the British are going to pull out and that there will be then a huge civil war, which the Republic will be incapable of actually responding to.
Yeah, the intersection between international sort of political economy and what's going on in the North is really interesting. I think you point out at some stage there's a politician maybe basically says, like, we can't afford the North type of thing, like some of the arguments you hear being made in the current context. Towards this is sort of related. Towards the end of the book, you get into a discussion about the rise of revisionism in the 1960s and 70s, which basically were orthodox accounts of modern Irish history and the conflicts start to come under increasing scrutiny. And you seem to accept that, yes, this revisionist impulse is top down in many ways. It comes from the academy, it comes from the state and the establishment media. But I think what's original about your argument is that you're saying it's also to some extent a bottom-up reaction, part of a much wider disengagement from the North and the Republican movement. Is that a fair enough sort of characterization of what you're getting at?
Yeah, I suppose what was interesting is that I'm trying to, and it's very hard to do because it is within living memory and an awful lot of the players are still around. So people obviously are judged by what you do now. So people read Kevin Myers now, for example, who your listeners and probably have heard of, as kind of notorious revisionist. I think someone said the most westerly of West Brits or whatever he's been described as, and people like Owen Harris and so on, who kind of, you know, nobody believes Owen Harris's hype more than Owen Harris himself, but Owen Harris would argue, you know, we were holding the line against fascism and so on in RTE and all these places. The problem is that that's not what people were saying in the 1970s. It's not what even they were saying. So you've got to judge people on what they did at the time rather than simply what they say they were doing now. And we all change our views, you know, to a great extent. But Kevin Myers resigned from RTE in 1972 in protest at Section 31 censorship. He's the only journalist to have done that. So his views weren't the same as they are now. Owen Harris in 1972 was a socialist Republican. And if you look at what they were doing within RTE, it wasn't promoting a revisionist line. You know, they were actually making programs about internment that the government thought was propaganda for the IRA. So there's really a different story going on. I suppose that I wanted to get away from the kind of concentration on people like Conor Cruise O'Brien, who is obviously important because as well as being an academic, he's a government minister. But Section 31 was introduced in the 1960s by Fianna Fáil. And during 1971 and 72, the Fianna Fáil government are tightening the screws on RTE and the media. And the Fianna Fáil government are bringing in all this kind of repressive legislation. And because then that they're followed by a coalition government who are much more associated with that, people tend to assume that it all came from them, when actual fact, there was a kind of a consensus at government level that things were getting out of hand and that you had to have more stringent security legislation and so on. I think it's Joe Lee makes the point in his book that while Fianna Fáil did this, they always kind of made it look like a painful necessity, whereas Fine Gael looked like they were enjoying it. And I think that is a cultural difference. And it also means that people, you'll never get an academic article about Gerry Collins, who was Minister for Posts and Telegraphs and Section 31, for example, because he just implemented it and didn't write about it. Whereas Conor Cruise O'Brien wrote books about why he needed to censor people. So I wanted to kind of get away from that kind of cliche of the revisionist and look at where else these ideas were coming from. And you've got historians like John A. Murphy, who might be put in the same box, but actually is saying quite different things. He's saying, you know, the Republican tradition is honourable. 1916 was legitimate, but this is different now. So people like Cruise O'Brien were saying the whole lot was wrong. I mean, Ruth Dudley Edwards, when she writes her book on Pearse in 1977, she says, you know, logically Pearse would be in the Provost because they believe the same thing. Now, if you're a Republican, you think, well, that's good. You know, she's saying what we say, that we are in the tradition of Pearse, whereas people like Murphy were saying, no, Pearse and Co. in 1916 wanted something completely different. They had a much more, you know, humanistic idea of Ireland than these people today. So there's differences that you have to kind of examine. And I think Murphy is closer to the popular view, which again, people might find hypocritical, but is a very strong one in the South, which is that there is something different about 1916 and the War of Independence in comparison to the 70s, which again is another day's discussion. But I was also kind of interested in looking at people like Con Houlihan, who people would know more in the South as a sports writer, but who in the Kerryman newspaper in the early 70s is writing, you know, basically this, that you know, there's Southern nationalism, republicanism is sectarian. Why would any Northern Protestant want to be part of this clerically dominated state? It's the working class who are basically suffering all the time in either part of Ireland. And then ultimately that, you know, the violence of the IRA is illegitimate. It has no sanction from the people. And I think people like him were just as influential in some ways, even though they weren't in kind of governmental positions. And their kind of revisionism comes from a different place. And again, people might kind of find it surprising, but there is that, again, stereotypically, you could call it the O'Casey, Sean O'Casey idea. But you do have people who are working class and even working class activists who in the 1970s would say that the North isn't really their concern, that actually nationalism is kind of, you know, just keeping people divided and that it's all a kind of a con. And you do find that expressed by people outside of the kind of stereotype of the revisionist. Again, people probably would be surprised that newspapers like the Sunday Independent would have had interviews with representatives of the IRA Army Council in the 1970s, or that they serialized Mike Farrell's The Orange State in 1976, published extracts and then gave pages over to John Hume and John Taylor to critique the book. But nevertheless, you know, people think the Sunday Independent, well, that's, you know, that hates Northerners and it hates nationalists. There's a kind of a conflation of the 1990s with the 1970s, and they were quite different, I think, in terms of public discussion. So the revisionism is a complex thing, and people can accept elements of it and reject others. And another point I wanted to kind of try and examine was how things that the IRA did in Britain often have a huge impact on Southern opinion. And partially that's because I think a lot more people in the South had relatives in Britain than they had relatives in the North. How things like the Miami Massacre has a huge impact in the South because they're really familiar to an awful lot of people, whereas other horrendous things have much less impact. And then that question of why do people view the IRA of 1919 to 21 or 23 so differently? And I think that's partially because people identify with them culturally. They want them to be different. And you can say that's hypocritical or it's unhistorical, but it's a genuine kind of emotion. It means people have very contradictory ideas about the modern IRA as well, which I wanted to show as well, you know, that this idea that everybody in the South rejected Republican violence is simply not true. There was support for the Provisional IRA, and there was certainly support for some of the things they did. And in the early 70s, quite a lot of sympathy. But that then is tempered by, you know, horror at a lot of stuff that does go on, and a kind of growing disengagement, the idea that this is never going to be solved. You know, this is going to go on forever, and it's not really anything to do with our daily lives.
Yeah. So what you're saying is there is a disengagement, but not an entire disengagement. You know, there is some sympathy for the Republican movement that holds it up throughout that period.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that the South is quite important in terms of a different discussion, but the kind of the mechanics of the Republican movement and what they do. But there is also that kind of within mainstream opinion as well. I mean, Republicans themselves would say it, and I do think it's true, that your kind of formal adherence to, say, in theory in the 1970s, Provisional Sinn Féin rejected the Southern state in its entirety and still called it obviously the Free State. And, you know, there's the whole question of abstentionism and things like that. But that actually people who voted Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael or Labour, or who had a whole range of views, would hide people who were on the run or would put money in a collection tin or would allow Republicans the use of their farm or something, while still not having the least bit of interest in the second all or, you know, that kind of stuff, you know. And I think that is true. And I suppose I was struck by there was a bit of a controversy a couple of years ago when a Sinn Féin TD tweeted about the similarity between Warren Point and Kilmichael. And it was a big backlash. And a lot of it was again, quite hypocritical. And even Mary Lou McDonald said, you know, oh, the mistake was to conflate the two things. And I was saying, well, you know, there was a very different public reaction in 1979 to two things that happened in the same day. You've Warren Point and 18 British soldiers killed. And I think quite a lot of people would have accepted in some way that there was some legitimacy in that. And that if the IRA had to kill anybody, you know, it would be members of the parachute regiment. But on the same day, Mountbatten is blown up along with two teenagers and an elderly woman. And people are genuinely horrified by that. And people can think the same thing. I mean, there's a quote, you know, in the book, I think, of someone in Tralee, you know, someone saying, you know, this is horrible. This is an atrocity. And then a few minutes later saying, but the Paras, that's different. They deserved it. And people could think that. And I would say again that the in 1979, there's no, if you go, you know, online, there'd be all sorts of stuff about Mountbatten and various things. That isn't what people say in 1979. I mean, it's you know, the Republican movement says they killed him because he's technically a military officer and a member of the royal family. And most people just regard it as unbelievable. The editorial in the Irish press, you know, by Tim Pat Coogan, it says this is just the execution of a 79-year-old man. What kind of people come up with this type of terminology? You know, this is a shameful day for Ireland. So people are horrified by that, but they're not horrified by everything, you know, and there is that kind of contradictory emotional reactions that people will have, and also their political reactions to these things. So I think it is quite complex, and it's not as clear cut as almost anybody would say today. But there is a disengagement, and there is, I think, the armed struggle as it developed was very difficult for most people in the South to identify with in its entirety and to accept in its entirety. And I don't think they were ever going to do that.
Yeah, I'd love to, so part of me wants to bring that discussion on revisionism up to the present day to touch on some of the things we actually talked about offline. That contradiction between memory and history and the good old IRA and all of that stuff, that debate is very much alive in here now.
Yeah, and I think it is a debate that's worth having, and I think it is a debate that people are right, you know, in some ways to see these things as moral issues, obviously. But for me, it's not primarily about morality. It's about the context, and the context of the struggle for independence from 1916 to 21, 23 or whatever. And then the conflict that begins after 1969 and the way that people reacted. You know, I think you have to look at a whole range of kind of things there. I understand why people find the debate hypocritical in some ways, but I think there's also a wider debate then about how you, our understanding of what, for example, unionists think about all this, you know, their stereotypes about the South. I mean, I think they would be much quicker to believe that the South was a hotbed of IRA support, and that actually the various governments were involved in, you know, fomenting the conflict. And then the kind of, I was struck, Paul Bew had an article a couple of weeks ago in the Irish Times where he said, you know, things have got very cold again for unionists in the South. And part of that's Brexit, but it's also because they don't have any voices in the media. You know, you used to have Owen Harris, you used to have Ruth Dudley Edwards and so on. And I was like, I just thought, that really, does he really think that was a positive for unionists to have people like that seen as your representatives? Because I actually think that, you know, firstly, they presented caricatures, both of nationalists and unionists. They contributed really nothing in their later kind of writings to an understanding. You know, these are just people who are engaged in a culture war and in polemic and so on, which actually doesn't allow people to really understand where unionists are coming from, or also the diversity of unionism. You know, there's a big difference between you know, people from working class unionism and the middle class and the politicians and so on, and yet, you know, he seems to think that this is something that's missing. You know, it is missing, but what's missing is a working class unionist voice, or even, you know, somebody putting forward the unionist view in a different way to the kind of caricature that people like Harris and Dudley Edwards did. So I think that there does need to be a discussion about how the South responded to the North, what people really think about the North, about flags and emblems and so on. And again, I mean, I should say that I've had discussions about the likelihood of United Ireland with students and so on. And they're as obsessed with flags and emblems as unionists are, far more than they are about taxation or the health system and so on, because unfortunately, a lot of people do see their identity as wrapped up in symbolism more than, you know, the idea of, you know, a functioning All-Ireland Health Service and things. And I think we do need to kind of look at all those questions about how much of this discussion is driven by, on the one hand, a fear of the North itself, how much disengagement there has been between nationalists over a century of partition. Because again, in 1922, you do hear people complaining about Belfast refugees in Dublin. You do even have Republicans complaining that they're demanding and so on. And this is, you know, you can't blame that on a century of partition, because partition had only been in place for, you know, scarcely a year. And you do have differences then among Republicans about what exactly do you say about the North. And that's apparent even a century ago. So to have that discussion would be worthwhile too, but also then to say, how do we engage with this idea of the impact of a conflict, really, which, you know, again, the trite way to do it is say, well, there was a war and wars are terrible and people get killed in wars, but that's all, you know, over now. So we just move on. That's not really going to be the case until, you know, everybody who was alive in that period is gone, you know? And that's, so I think, you know, part of that is an understanding of what was happening in the South.
Yeah, and part of it will come with the passing of time, but I think certainly we need to have that debate. Sounds very like you've created another bit of work for yourself, if anyone's listened to this.
I would, I suppose, like to bring it up to the 1990s at some point. And that would include then that 1972 is never matched in terms of popular mobilization. I mean, there's a chapter in the book about the aftermath of Bloody Sunday, and that is just vast in terms of its spontaneity and in terms of the kind of range of people involved in protest. But then in 1980-81, you do have in the South the reaction to the hunger strikes, which does, you know, is much larger than anything else for a long period. And I think it's in some ways it's more politicized than after Bloody Sunday, but it's smaller as well. But it does have a long lasting impact. I would say that some of the people who become involved in republicanism in the 1980s from the South, they're all basically come in because of the hunger strikes and so on. And then you have that 1980s, 1990s period where, you know, it still is a major cultural issue in the South, your attitudes towards the North. And you know, luckily there is, again, some way of looking at what people said at the time, you know, because thankfully there is magazines like Hot Press, for example, where everybody who's interviewed is asked about the North, and where lots of political figures are also questioned, and what they said at the time is very interesting in terms of trying to get an idea of what the kind of the prevailing mood was. So I would like to bring it up further into the 1990s at some stage, but again, who knows when we get around to that.
Well, no, for me, I'd like to see that debate start to open up, and I mean, I think you've done a great job and starting to kickstart it, I suppose.
Thanks very much. But again, I was wary of the fact, and I say this, that of basing too much on kind of childhood memories, you know, that, yeah. That you're building a theory on what. But I honestly, there was times when I put a quote in because I'd actually heard people saying things like that. And I do remember the aftermath of Warren Point and the contrasting views of people about the two different, about Mountbatten and about the Paras, you know, that people would believe one was, you know, well, tough luck, you know, they're in the British Army, but the other thing is absolute barbarity. And then that kind of confusion, you'd always find it, you know, with people. And also then that other thing, which, as I said, annoys people from the North, where, you know, a shooting in the South is taken 100 times more seriously and seen as far more newsworthy or horrible than a range of very horrible things that were happening all the time in the six counties.
Well, look, I can't recommend your book highly enough. Like, and what we'll do is we'll post a link to it in the show notes so that people can read it for themselves. And I'll take my word for it. We've covered a lot of ground there and taken up a lot of your time already. So we look forward to picking up on some of those other issues on another day. But until then, I just want to thank you very much, Brian, for taking the time out to speak to us. And until next time, I want to thank everyone else for listening.
Thanks very much.
That, comrades, was Trademark Belfast. Thanks so much for listening in. We'll see you soon, either in the trenches or on the victory parade. Up the workers and Sláinte go Fóill.